Oh, wait, that's me. Sorry, I'm running. Oh, my God. I'm completely waiting for James.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
It's the Ricochet Podcast. I'm Rob Long, joined with Peter Robinson, sitting in for James Lilex and Steve Hayward. And today we've got Senator John Hoeven and longtime guest John Yoo. So stick around.
And yet, for those of you in the media who don't report on that, you should be ashamed. This is evil. And the reason you don't see any Democrats here is they can't defend this. They're counting on the press not to cover it. It's wrong.
Hello and welcome to the Ricochet Podcast. This is podcast number 642. We're going to have to stop. We're going to have to recalibrate these like the Argentinian currency or the new franc. I am Rob Long, joined as always by my Ricochet co-founder, Peter Robinson in Palo Alto. Hello, Peter.
Hello, hello.
We are usually joined by James Lilex. He's not here today. And sitting in for him is Steve Hayward. Steve, how are you?
I am good, Rob. Good to see you guys.
Now, so where are you, Steve? Do you mind asking where exactly you are?
Yeah, I'm kind of hard to pin down, a little bit like you. I'm currently at my main residence in the central coast of California, near Paso Robles.
Oh, nice.
Any idea how that sounds? If only our viewers could see how tightly you've curled your pinky as you say that. Thurston Howells. I'm at my main residence just down the hill from the Hearst Castle.
Sorry.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a lot going on today. We are joined later by Senator John Hoeven from North Dakota. I can't believe it. A former senator. Former governor, now senator. So he's... why isn't he running for president, Peter? Well, we should wait and ask that
ask
question.
Ask him.
Maybe he's too smart.
He has a very good life as it is. He enjoys his state, his family, and his grandchildren, and the Senate. And why mess it up? Anyway, I think that's the...
And then later, John Yoo will be here. I have to introduce John Yoo. We all know John Yoo. John will be here to talk about... I guess there was some legal stuff in the news. We can talk about that. But before we get to that, before we get to the senator, before we get to Professor Yoo... can we talk a little bit about drugs? A Danish study shows that up to 30% of psychosis diagnoses in young men could have been prevented if these individuals had not used marijuana.
Yes.
So I guess it's the biggest epidemiological investigation. We should talk to our friend Jay Bhattacharya about that to date. And it does seem like this news comes in an inopportune time when, if you live in New York City, you smell weed everywhere, and it is now legal almost everywhere, and it is considered as benign, if not more benign, than a martini.
Well, Ross Douthat has a piece in the New York Times. I continue to read the Times only for the sake of our friend Ross. Ross Douthat has a piece in the New York Times saying that the effect legalization of marijuana, it's a little more complicated than that, but in effect, it's been legalized across. The cops have stopped enforcing any marijuana laws almost everywhere. And there are shops all over New York, as there are all over Los Angeles, black market, regulated shop. It just, they're there. Ross says, A, this was a very big mistake. B, it's almost impossible to say so because, and I'd like to hear Rob opine on this one. I'd like to hear both of you, but Rob in particular, because for several decades now, all the forces of what is cool and with it and correct educated opinion have been in favor of legalization, and it is almost impossible to raise a finger and say, folks, there's already evidence that this is doing millions of people serious harm because it sounds so square. Polite opinion is just not attuned to hearing that, whatever the evidence.
So you are worried, Peter, about sounding square? Is that...
No, I'm worried about you.
Sounding square.
We've known each other 3 decades. You've always been the cool one, and that's not even close.
That's and here you not are, saying for, much, but yeah.
Here you are. Well, I suppose I set a low bar, but no, you're the cool conservative, and here you are saying something square. Cognitive dissonance?
Well, I don't know what I think of it. So, Steve, help me out here.
He's stepping. Look at him.
And he's punting immediately.
Did you notice that?
All right. He's slipping and sliding away.
I thought I was pretty good, actually.
All right, I'll weigh in with a couple of thoughts. One is, this really isn't a brand new finding, this Danish study. I think if it catches the eyebrows, it's because it's from those free-swinging Scandinavians, right? There have been lots of medical studies calling into question the effects of marijuana, that we've underestimated them and so forth. And yet Peter, like you say, you cannot question this because it's an awful lot like some of the research on gender dysphoria and the whole trans phenomenon, that there's active suppression of contrary findings to what is currently fashionable. I don't know if you know this, Peter. Rob, you probably don't. In the California legislature, there's currently a bill that would outlaw, by degrees over 20 years, all tobacco sales in California. So if it passed and was signed, we would have a world in which you couldn't buy tobacco products of any kind, but marijuana would remain legal. Well, why is that? Well, we know why. Isn't that astounding? Now, I think 2 things quickly, and then I'll stop. You've had this proliferation of marijuana products. It's not just weed that you roll up and smoke anymore. It's all these different edibles. It's oils. It's on and on and on. Of varying degrees of potency. I mean, I don't know these things firsthand myself, but, I hear that the industry and the people who've been doing this for decades have really figured out how to calibrate very high potency weed and so forth.
Yeah.
And along with the sort of approval that the legalization has bestowed on it, I think that the use of it has spread. And there isn't any, what do we do about smoking 50 years ago? We started telling people that smoking was bad. And we're not telling people that they should be careful, at least, about their marijuana use. And so I think we're going to regret the rush to legalize it and promote it the way we have. Finally, by the way, the marijuana industry in California, the legal industry, is losing money because it's overregulated and overtaxed. And only in California could you make the weed industry unprofitable.
Right, but the black market, are we even allowed to say black? The market of color? I don't even know what the illegal, the unregulated market is just everywhere. It's this weird thing where the argument was, look, maybe it does some damage, not much, but a little bit. We're going to legalize it, but then we will be able to regulate it. We'll make sure that it's safe. We'll be able to spot people right away who seem to be having trouble. And that hasn't happened at all. What actually has happened is that the illegal market, let's call it that, that's what has blossomed. If you're crazy enough to try to stay within the regulations, you have to sell your pot at a higher price to deal with all the regulatory overhang. So you get undercut by the shop down. And it just means that whatever control we had, we've lost altogether.
Correct? Yeah, I mean, I think
that, am I overstating?
I think that's absolutely correct. I don't think so. I think 2 things happened. One is that people, the very very strange thing, if people thought that the reason that it was that you would ever sell something illegally was because it was illegal and not because you wanted to circumvent regulations. So, if you love regulation, you think, well, the minute you put regulations on this, everyone's going to conform, which of course isn't what happens. You still want to circumvent it. You still sell weed on the street here in New York City, or you sell it illegally in some bodegas because the permitting process is complicated, apparently, or all that stuff. The second thing is that we live in this weird culture where it isn't enough to say, well, this stuff should be legal, but it's not good for you.
Right. And this should be legal
and you should be for it. The progressive mentality is that anything that's good for you must be compulsory. And that is sort of like the old PJ O'Rourke formulation was, in a communist country, everything is illegal except for a few things, and those things are compulsory. And so the idea that, like, saying, hey, look, marijuana can be very dangerous, like rum, and it should be regulated and maybe even frowned upon, like beer or rum. I mean, I see people walking down the street smoking weed all the time. I smell it from construction sites all the time. And if those people were holding in Manhattan.
And those people were holding highballs. How recently? This is new, correct?
No. This is like, you know, this is like past 6 months, 2 years, 3 years, right?
Okay. All right.
But the pre-legalization, pre-decriminalization. So definitely was considered fine before city law dotted the I, as you might say. It was wide open. I mean, nobody was ever arrested for this. But the idea that it isn't just so much that people are doing it out in the open. It's that if you replace that with a martini glass, if you saw two guys sitting on the stoop on 11th Street before they go back into the house to rewire that townhouse they're working on, and they're sitting there drinking beer or a highball or a martini, you'd think, hey, dudes, no. That's after work situation, right? But you can't say that because you can't say that. And full disclosure, I don't smoke it. I don't like it. I hate the smell. But you can't say to somebody, "All right, this is another one of your vices," but it's a vice. That apparently is it has to solve everything. And you know, you put the weed cream on your knee, and your knee doesn't hurt anymore. Like we have lost the ability to sort of be normal about anything. Again, this goes to my working definition or working theory of everything last week was everyone has lost their minds. And I think that this is just one more instance of everybody losing their mind, unable to say, all right, this is your vice of choice. Be careful with it. And maybe kids shouldn't be doing it.
I think it may be worse than you think about everyone losing their minds, Rob. I think this ought to connect to a larger phenomenon, which also was reported this week, which is the mortality rate among young Americans is up 10% over the last couple of years. We know that life expectancy in the United States has taken a dive for the first time in, well, ever, really. And Peter, you'll remember that back around 1980, when Rinaldus Magnus ascended to the presidency, the first hint that the clever intelligence people got that the Soviet Union was in trouble was falling lifespans in the Soviet Union. It had been rising and after World War II, and suddenly it took a dive in the late 70s. People like our friend Nick Eberstadt said, there's something deeply wrong in that country. Now, we can point to, in this country, fentanyl, marijuana, rising suicide rates, soaring rates of mental health distress among young Americans. Can we tease that?
I am with Jay Bhattacharya. I am convinced that the COVID lockdown was, I mean, I have kids. It was catastrophic for kids, in particularly teens and 20s, who are supposed to be getting out, meeting people, learning how to socialize like adults. Right. And am I wrong about that, or doesn't that play into this?
No, that's absolutely right. But this can have a long-lasting effect. And so I think we need to have a wider angle view than just the problem of marijuana and other things. I think this is now a long-term problem that we have. I think there's a crisis underway, and it's a cultural crisis as much as it is any particular thing like marijuana or fentanyl.
It has to be. So forth. If I could bring my father back to life and say, well, listen, you lived through the Depression. You served all 4 years of the Second World War at sea. Take a look. What do you think? He would be dazzled by the wealth, the ease of life, the conveniences. I remember the year, it was happened to be the same year he died. I showed him for the first time he'd seen it, an email, and he just shook his head. He said, "Magic." Okay. Mm-hmm. And the idea that kids are killing themselves or resorting to fentanyl and booze and marijuana, this just would not compute. This is not the country for which he went to war. Something serious has gone wrong, and it's in our heads. We're not poor. It's in our heads.
By the way, Peter, on a lighter note for this grim subject, the first time I showed my mother an email, her question back to me was, how does it get out of the envelope and into your computer?
That's not a dumb question, really, when you're right down to it.
Not a dumb question.
But Peter, I think you're right. I think it's a constellation of things. I think like a lot of what happened in COVID, it amplified and exacerbated trends that we already had. I think actually the group that was targeted the most for harm were sort of preteens and early teens, so like middle school, young high school, early high school, because they really were coming out of their shell and coming out of the home and coming out of the nest at that point. So, and that devastation is huge. I think there's other parts of it too, which are that we And it's in Richard Reeves' great book. Richard Reeves, guy at the Brookings Institution, wrote a book called Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. And I think he's pointing at some very, very serious problems we have in the country with how we raise men and how we raise boys.
Yes.
And as you all know, when you fail at that, only bad things happen. Young men are the prime engine for social chaos and crime and all sorts of terrible things when they are not raised well or parented well. And I think that's what's happening, not only by their parents, but probably by the culture in general, which is, these are all big, fat topics. We can keep talking about them, or we can switch to other big, fat topics, because we are lucky to have John Hoeven. He was the 31st, as I said, 31st governor of North Dakota from 2000 to 2010. He is now the senior U.S. senator from North Dakota. He's been on the podcast many times. He's a friend of our of the podcast. So I got a big question for him. So I gave a little thumbnail sketch of your successful term as the governor of North Dakota, and now that you're the current senior U.S. senator there. Why on earth are you not running for president? And don't come up with I don't want any excuses here. I want you to say, you know what? Good point, Rob. I'm in.
So, Rob, it is great to be with you and Stephen. I don't know if Peter's joining or not, but I see both you guys are from Berkeley. And I kind of marveled at that, because, you know, Peter is a Reagan Republican and a staunch conservative. And here I find out he's hanging out with two guys from Berkeley.
Yes, it's the best I can do.
I know this is directly germane to your question, so I thought I'd launch right into it, you know. So, Peter, what gives?
I live in California, Senator. I do the best I can, and that's how low I've sunk. These guys are the best I can do. Hey, Senator, you were down at the border just last week, and I saw you on my Twitter feed was filled with you, and it sounded as though you were shocked at what you saw. So I'd like to ask two questions. What did you see? And why does the senator from North Dakota care? Do the illegals make it as far as north as your state?
Well, sure. It affects every state in the union. You know that, Peter. The fentanyl, the human trafficking. This is a national problem. And border security is national security. Remember, we are a border state, and we're seeing, our resources on the northern border being, taken down to the southern border. And so, we're starting to see problems on the northern border. North Dakota, we have responsibility for actually 900 miles of border for all the way from essentially the Great Lakes out through part of Montana, because we have the Grand Forks sector. And so, we're familiar with border issues. Obviously, it's very different on the northern border than it is in the southern border. But yeah, this is affecting every single state in the country. You're seeing it in a lot of ways. Obviously, the human trafficking, the drugs, the fentanyl. We're over 100,000 deaths in fentanyl last year. The numbers keep growing, so it's affecting all of us and our kids. And border security is national security. So back to, you said, look, I wasn't shocked, because I've been down there many times now. I'm doing everything. I keep going back because I want to solve the problem, and the solution is for the Biden administration to enforce the law. It's that simple. And they've got to quit telling the American people that somehow if Congress did something or whatever, then they could secure the border. No, they need to enforce the Remain in Mexico policy and the Third Safe Country policy. And that's the law. If they would enforce it, that would stop the illegal flow right now. We can get into more details, but it is that simple and it is that direct. They're obfuscating. Alejandro Mayorkas is obfuscating. That's all that is. They have the tools, and in fact, they have a responsibility to enforce the law and stop this border crisis now.
Hey, Senator, so why is it so, I mean, the way you lay it out, it seems like it should be easily done. Why is it so difficult? I mean, people voted in 2016 for a candidate who said he's going to build a wall, and he didn't build it. And he has all sorts of excuses why he didn't build it. We can come up with all the reasons why, but he didn't build it. He replaced some parts that Obama built, but he didn't actually build any new wall. It feels to me like securing the border isn't that complicated. I mean, or at least the idea being, if once you make it harder to cross the border, you kind of send a message all the way down to the tip of Tierra del Fuego that this is not a done deal. Don't set off on foot for something that's going to be really difficult. Don't come. Why is this so difficult? I mean, I have a hard time believing the sort of very prevalent conservative theory that this is the goal of the liberals and the Democrats is to replace conservatives with loyal Democratic voters. But what are the other reasons why it can't just be done?
So, Rob, if you look at what happened with the last administration, essentially we did get control of the border. And we do need a border wall, border barrier, whatever you want to call it. And it's not the same in all places along the border. It's different depending on the topography and the situation. Rural areas, obviously California, different than Texas, different than Arizona, New Mexico, so forth. So,
right.
One, you do need a border barrier. And you also need the people and the technology so that you actually have control of the border. And that's not only so you can manage the flow of what comes through. And then you need technology at the ports of entry so you can scan these, you know, millions of vehicles that come across that have contraband, drugs, other things. And so you need, that's why you need the technology. And then the other thing that does, Rob, is once you get control of the ports of entry, then your Border Patrol can actually track all the areas in between and make sure that the coyotes and the cartels are not bringing people across, the human trafficking and the drug smuggling. But then also you're seeing terrorists come across the border and the cartels want to establish their criminal organizations in our country as well. And so it all goes together. And back to where Peter started, I've been at this for some time. In other words, a number of years ago, Governor, now Senator Shaheen and I, we were governors together back in the day, and she and I were chair and ranking member on the Appropriations Subcommittee that had DHS. We went down, we went all along the Texas border to check it out. So we worked on the funding back leading into Trump wanting to put up the border barrier, which he did, rebuild a lot of that. He did as much as he could in his 4 years. But now a lot of those areas, the Biden people are just leaving the materials sitting there on the ground, materials that we've paid for rather than finishing the wall. But I've been to McAllen, Del Rio, Eagle Pass. I've been to El Paso. That just in the last year plus, I've been on the other side to Mexico, Ecuador, to Guatemala, to Colombia. And the thing is, what's going on right now is that because the Biden administration will not enforce the law, very simply, the Remain in Mexico, right, Third Safe Country, that would stop it right now because CBP and Border Patrol, then those professionals, they could then take control of the border right now, even without additional barrier, but he won't do it. And furthermore, now that Title 42 has expired, right, Mayorkas is saying they're enforcing Title 8. They are not. Under Title 8, you actually have to have an asylum plan, you know, for persecution, not because you just want to immigrate. You actually have to be persecuted. You have to have an asylum claim to stay in the country. And so so what Mayorkas is saying is under Title 8, they're enforcing that. They're not, because the individual comes across. He says, you know, I'm here. I want to have asylum or whatever. They say, no, you have to go back and remain in Mexico. He says, I want to appeal it. And then once he appeals it, they give him a phone number. That counts as a preliminary hearing. He calls and he says, I have credible fear, unless the judge says, no, you got to go back. But the judge has nothing to go on. So they stay. They're issued an alien identification number. They get benefits. They get a work permit. They're here. And they don't actually have a court hearing date, Rob, for about 3 to 5 years. So that's not enforcing the law.
And even then, they can skip it. Yeah.
And then they don't go to that hearing. You know, they're here for 5 years. That's it. They're here.
Senator Steve Hayward out in California. I'm so old, I can remember when many leading Democrats took a hawkish position on this issue. You can think of Barbara Jordan's famous speech in the 1970s, the Democratic Convention, Bill Clinton in the 1990s, even Barack Obama around 2010 had some hawkish rhetoric, at least, about the issue.
And Gene Shaheen was working with the senator, as John just said.
Right. Well,
Democrat,
I'm wondering,
New Hampshire.
Somewhere in the last decade, to make a long story short, the Democrats seem to have sold out to the open borders ideology for whatever reasons. I think there are a lot of bad ones. Really, they're all bad ones. And yet, in the last 10 days or so since the demise of Title 42 became imminent, you've seen several starting to change their mind a bit. Senator Brown in Ohio. Maybe it's a coincidence that it's senators who are up for re-election next year, but still, the question is, do you think that they're not, that there's a change among Democrats who are worried about this, at least enough of them? Is there possibly a majority in Congress for a tougher stance on immigration?
I think so. I hope so. And there needs to be. But that's why I say every American needs to truly understand what's going on. When Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas sits and looks at you and says it's a, you know, the border's closed and he's enforcing Title 8, he is not. And people need to understand it, because when enough Americans across this country simply understand that the Biden administration could stop this right now if they just enforce the law, which is their job, and that those folks all call their senators and their House members on the other side of the aisle and say, enough of this. And think about, look at what's going on in New York right now, where now they're starting to house migrants in public schools and parents are coming out. Think about Mayor Adams complaining about Governor Abbott from Texas sending some busloads of illegal migrants up there. Well, that's 10% of what he's getting. He should be calling the White House. It's the White House that's sending up the tens of thousands to him. And so as you see these problems continue to grow, even in the so-called sanctuary cities, I hope enough Americans will call their elected representatives and say enough and get the Biden administration to stop this.
Senator, if I'd like to ask you a question on a different subject for a moment.
Sure.
Before you entered public service, you were a very successful banker. So obviously, I want to get your summary perspective on what's been happening with Silicon Valley Bank and the slow rolling crisis we're having right now. First Republic, all the rest of that. What should we think about this? What are our takeaways? What should we be watching for?
Well, clearly, in that case, the bank was mismanaged and the regulators weren't on top of it, and they should have been. And when that happens, those banks should fail. I mean, they should go out of business just like other businesses go out of business. That does not undermine the soundness of the overall system. And that's what we need to separate, this conflating a bank failure where it was poorly run, where they got into all the high-tech stuff, where the regulators didn't stay on top of it. That is, yes, an individual case, and that bank should go out of business. And, but that doesn't threaten the safety and soundness of the other banks. And we can't get into this deal where, you know, you bail out every bank. That is not what should be happening.
Well, that was going to be my next question is, do you agree with the decision to lift the deposit insurance cap?
Well, what they started to do, Stephen, was they were going to arrange a sale or facilitate a sale to that bank or the banks, which obviously was going to happen. There were bidders. And that's let the market, you know, sure, they can help with it, but the market would have taken care of that by, and you've seen that now subsequently with these other banks where, you know, the other banks will step in and buy them because they want those depositors. They want that customer base. But it shouldn't be federal bailout, no.
I mean, is in a way, Senator, could you actually say that when banks go bust, it's a sign that the system is healthy, that it's only unhealthy when you create this attitude among bankers that regulators will step in and bail you out?
Well, Rob, yeah. Why should every bank be able to stay in business? No way. If they're poorly run and so on and so forth, they should go out of business. And, you know, and they need to be held accountable. But the system is sound, and other banks will step up and acquire that deposit base. And so, I mean, the system will work. It wasn't designed that you go in and bail out every bank. That was, right. It was never designed that.
Okay, so you want to jump in, Peter? Go right ahead.
I want to change topics.
Me too.
I
want to talk about politics a little bit.
Yeah, okay, me too. So I'm going to go first.
Peter, can I ask a question?
You?
Is that the library in your home that you're sitting in? Is that your study?
The library in his head.
Senator, I'm a little surprised. I guess this shows that you weren't the most studious student at Dartmouth College.
Well, you know that.
This is one of the libraries inside Baker at Dartmouth. Nice try, though. All right, Senator.
That was kind of good, wasn't it? It's really hard to get here. Yeah.
Throwing me
totally.
Off.
I can't solve all this senator stuff. As he just revealed, we've been friends since college, so I'm going to call him John. John, Donald Trump beat Joe Biden in North Dakota by 2-1, 66 to 32%.
Right.
Now, that wasn't as big a margin as yours. When you get yourself reelected, your margins are something like 4 or 5 to 1. It is just amazing. Donald Trump's running again. Ron DeSantis, what are you? What's your position? Trump was complicated. You and I discussed this once, and you said your people up in North Dakota have trouble with Trump as a man, but they sure like his policies. What position does that put you
in? His policies have been very good, as you know. But you know, I take the approach that I've taken pretty much every time. I think we have to be careful, Peter, about not, this is when the grassroots, when the Republicans, the people that work their rear end off for all those candidates year in and year out, this is when they get to vet everybody, when they, you know, they get to weigh in and have an opinion. And I think we make a mistake if we don't spend some time listening to that. And, you know, finding out who's running, finding out what people think. And I think we're pretty early on in that process. As a matter of fact, you're going to see Tim Scott.
Yeah.
Who's marvelous. I'm sure you know him. He's a phenomenal person. The kind of guy that can bring people together. He's tremendous. DeSantis is going to get in. You know, I was disappointed to see that Mike Pompeo, at least at this point, says he's going to pass. He's tremendous. There are very talented people that are going to be in this race. And let's give the process a little time to unfold. And let's be careful not to be trying to tell people how they should vote too darn quick. This is when the grassroots get to speak. Let's listen to him a little bit and just kind of see how this goes.
Okay, so
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so you're really and truly telling us that it's open-ended right now. Donald Trump does not have this wrapped up. Plenty of time to think things through, fall in love with this candidate, fall in love with another candidate. We do not know who's going to win the Republican nomination yet. You really believe that?
Peter, all the time I listen to you guys in the media world and, you know, with your prognostications and your polls and all the things every day. And I know you got it sliced and diced, you know, a year ahead of the whole of the election. But, you know, I've always kind of been one to say, well, we'll see. And I think, you know, I know, all kidding aside, it's always interesting to see the polls, the prognostications,
right,
all this kind of stuff. Hey, but hey, this debate's just getting started. And I think it's really important, and I think we've got a lot of talented people that are going to be involved.
Well, Senator, you adroitly skipped over my question at the start, and I'll let you off the hook. I want to ask you again, because I don't want you to say no too loudly, because I kind of feel like, well, maybe I kind of leave some room for you to change your mind. But can we just talk about the Senate in 2024? I mean, listen to you talk about immigration and banking and, you know, I'm sure go down the list. Well, like, do it, right? But it's hard for a Republican senator in 2023 to just make it happen. How likely do you think the Republican Party is to get control of the Senate in 2024 to really, really put into place a lot of these pieces of this agenda that we desperately need?
Bob, we need to. I mean, at the end of the day, you got to win elections. That's one of the things that drives me absolutely crazy. Is I listen to people say, well, you know, they got this great plan and procedure and all these kind of things, and somehow we're going to outsmart the other guys, and on and on and on, and we're going to get our way, even though we're in the minority. It doesn't work that way. We have to have more votes to get our policies in place. And this last midterm cycle, you saw that, you know, back to what I said a minute ago, we were going to get a majority in the Senate for sure, and on and on and on, and we didn't. And the country's suffering because of that. I don't care how smart or how nifty you are or how good you are at Robert's Rules of Orders or whatever. If they have more votes than we do, they carry their policies. You are seeing what the Democrat policies are doing to this country, and it is not good. So we have got to win the Senate, and we've got to win the presidency, and then get back to the kind of fundamentals that made this country strong. So number one, we got to win it. Number two, I'm hopeful that we can. But it's going to come back to winning the hearts and minds. And that this immigration discussion is a great example. The energy issue is a great example. The debt ceiling and the outrageous spending, the debt and the deficit is a great example. On every single one of these, we have the right solutions. And at the end of the day, we've got to convince not just our base, but enough of those people in the middle that we need to win for the good of this country. Right. And they always say the next election is the most important, but it sure feels that way.
Yeah, it sure feels that way. Can I ask you one? I know you got to run. I got one last question because you were born in Bismarck, North Dakota.
True.
You're from North Dakota. You've been the governor of the state, and now you're the senator from the state. Mm-hmm. And we think of, I say we think, people who don't live in that part of the country tend to think of that part of the country as kind of always the same, but it really isn't. What are the big ways that North Dakota has changed? The people that you represent, the people that you were the governor of, for the past 20 years, it feels like everywhere else in America has gone through some tumultuous, sometimes wrenching, sometimes very positive change. What about North Dakota?
Good question.
Yeah, I like that question, Rob. I really do like that question.
See, Peter, I can do this.
Huh? Yeah, exactly.
Not so hard.
Yeah. First off, I'm so honored to represent the people of North Dakota. And North Dakota has always been an ag powerhouse. We lead the nation in the production of, 14 or 15 different crops. We're number one in honey. We get livestock. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're a very strong ag state. We've always been an ag powerhouse. But we've added that. We're now an energy powerhouse. We're either second to Texas or sometimes New Mexico's in there because of the public lands in terms of oil and gas production. But we've also developed a lot more technology. We've gone from an older state to one of the youngest states because we're attracting people because we have a lot of jobs. We have a very high per capita income. Where we've changed is we've gone from kind of just a farming state to really doing a lot of these other things and innovating in some really exciting ways. So we're leading the country in carbon capture for our coal-fired electric industry. I think, in many ways, we've become a much more dynamic state. We're doing incredible things at unmanned aviation. We have this incredible tech park, Grand Sky up in Grand Forks. I think in that respect, like you say, every place changes. But I think we've retained that kind of fundamental, down-to-earth, common-sense approach that I think is, just a wonderful attribute for our state and something I think is really important for our country. Common sense.
So America should be a little bit more like North Dakota.
Well, of course I feel that way. You bet.
Senator, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it. I hope you come back again, especially as the 2024 general elect gets a little more complicated, a little more interesting. I'd love to hear some more of your perspective.
Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed being with you.
Thanks a lot, Senator.
Take care.
Tell Mrs. Hoven we send our best.
From
him again.
I don't know how to put it. From the heights of the of statesman like capital, from the governor's office to the brainchild of our founders. In
from
Senator John
filet
Hoven,
mignon to Philadelphia cheesesteak
to McRib, we now McRib. Welcome our old friend, Professor John Yu, professor at Bolt Law School. Wait, they still say Bolt, right? Don't they say
they don't? It got renamed. Oh, it got formally renamed. Yeah,
formerly named Berkeley Law School, fellow at Hoover and American Enterprise Institute, podcaster, co-star with equal billing for some reason. On Law Talk, and of course, he occasionally co-hosts with our own Steve Hayward. Welcome, John Yu.
Steve and I have this other podcast where we replace the whole bunch of you with one woman named Lucretia, whose identity we protect by using ancient Roman pseudonyms.
And she's more than a match with you.
If she had laryngitis, she'd still be better than you guys. Come on, we're going to do a head-to-head comparison after this is all over.
Hey, all right, funny time's over. John, Put yourself back briefly in the Department of Justice. Just pretend.
This is when we execute the search warrant on Robinson's house without a judge's permission. My age-old dream.
The Durham report comes out. And everybody reads it. Some people read it for the first time. Some people read it the Friday afternoon, and they release it on a Monday. How bad is it? Both from your perspective outside, and also if you were in there, what would you be saying inside the DOJ that Monday lunchtime after everybody's read this report?
I'm afraid the way a lot of people there think is, well, at least they're not going to fire me. So that's the first thing. They read the report to see where they're mentioned and to make sure they don't go. But seriously, they would worry that something has gone seriously wrong with the FBI and the Justice Department. All right, this is as harsh as you can get without actually throwing people in jail. All right, the FBI and the Justice Department are supposed to neutrally investigate crimes and to prosecute them. And what does the Durham report show? It's really not controverted these days, right? It's one, the incumbent party controlling the White House, their presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton, concocted a completely made-up scheme claiming that her opponent, right, the out-of-party candidate, was a Russian spy. Right? So that's just implausible on its face, no evidence, ridiculous. And either tricked, duped, or had willing conspirators in the FBI who took that information and launched a 2 to 3 year probe of a candidate, and then the winning candidate, right, a president. You sit there and say, what has happened to the idea of neutral, nonpartisan law enforcement? This is the thing. This Durham is not some outside investigator. He's one of their own, right? He's one of the most neutral, most nonpartisan.
Do you know him?
Prosecutors in the history of the department.
Did you know him?
I've met him maybe once.
So there's no beef here. We got to get uncovered. It comes down to a lot of things, but one of the things it comes down to is the subversion of the FISA process, right? Which is something that was predicted in 2000, whatever, when they were arguing the Patriot Act. I mean, people, especially libertarians and libertarians were saying, this is going to be trouble. We pass this, it's going to be trouble. And it turns out it's trouble. So how do you fix it?
This is the bigger picture, which I think goes beyond the Durham report that Durham barely addressed, which is, look, if I read this report and I put the words Al-Qaeda instead of Republican Party in, and I put Osama bin Laden instead of Donald Trump in, these were the tools that we created. But right. I know sometimes people on MSNBC make that mistake over and over again, but
right, they're actually different
people.
Yeah. Well, they prefer Osama.
Those powers and authorities were all supposed to be turned outward to investigate terrorists, to investigate foreign spies. The mistake they made, and this is, again, Durham does not really scratch the surface of how to think about this, how to cure it, is it was turned inwards. If you think about it, is exactly what happened in Watergate. This is exactly what Richard Nixon did. He used the CIA.
This is worse than Watergate, isn't it, John? Sorry.
Well, you and I, Steve, always think Nixon doesn't get all the credit he should get, and Watergate wasn't so bad. but it is exactly the same thing in the sense that these powerful tools like FISA, like surveillance, and so on, those were all supposed to be used to protect the national security from threats of all abroad, never supposed to be used to go after domestic, and specifically not to be used to interfere in political campaigns. That's the lesson of Watergate.
Well, but look, I mean, it's a thought experiment here. I mean, it's one thing to bug your opposition campaign, and it's one thing to try and prevent the FBI from investigating it, which are the two things we know Nixon or his people did. What if Nixon had used phony, made up intelligence to start a criminal investigation by the FBI and that everybody, all the people at the highest reaches knew about it. You know, Nixon didn't know about the Watergate burglary. We're pretty sure, we think anyway. Oh my goodness, they'd still be prosecuting Nixon even though he's been dead 30 years. I can't believe that this shouldn't at least raise the prospect of conspiracy charges against Hillary Clinton and the people around her, against people in the FBI. It seems to me that this ought to have serious criminal consequences, but it's been played out so slowly that it's sort of like the old Clinton playbook. If you just slow things down long enough, it'll just sort of evaporate and lose its force.
I feel bad for Durham, and he says in this report, he says, look, there's a lot of things here that went wrong. There was a lot of bad action. Not all bad action is criminal. Right? I can't, and he says this basically, look, I tried to prosecute two low-level people, and they were acquitted. The Justice Department rarely loses on acquittal. I mean, the Justice Department usually wins 90 to 95% right. of its cases. So Durham essentially said, look, I'm issuing this report so the American people and Congress can see all the bad things that were done, and you have to use other means to hold them accountable other than trying to throw them in jail, because that's not going to work. So I agree with you, Steve, that some of the things that happened here are worse in the sense of who was involved. It's almost worse in the sense that the bureaucracy, you know, Watergate was a few really bad apples. I'm watching this great HBO series starring Woody Harrelson, you know, Rob's old buddy. Right. Somehow they turned Rob's old buddy into a White House plumber. You know, Rob's got a future here. I think he'd be a great, you know, DNC chair getting hacked in the next miniseries on Hillary Clinton. But look, these are a few bad apples. Here, it's almost the bureaucracy, right? The leadership of the FBI of one mind believed it. So it's almost a greater threat, harder to cure in a way, Stephen, throwing a few people in jail.
John, Peter wants to get in, but before we go, like the Nixon analogy, Nixon comparison, I think it's really interesting because, you know, I know that, you know, I don't want to insult the two of you, you know, Nixonophiles, but like Nixon was kind of a weirdo and paranoid and had lots of weird, he was psychologically damaged and believed that he had enemies around the corner. And in case of Nixon, he kind of did, but like part of the weirdness of Watergate was that that someone felt they needed to break into the opposition office in Watergate Hotel. A person that pretty much was already at like zero in the polls, right? Nixon then went on to win, I mean, every single state, right? With one of the most smashing popular vote and electoral vote victories in American political history. And at the time that the Clinton administration, the Hillary Clinton campaign was devising this nonsense and trying to get FISA authorization, the polls were saying she was going to win, like, you know, 10, 20, 30 points all the way. Like, even election night, there were only a few people who were sort of inside. I mean, people in the Clinton administration, I mean, the Clinton campaign, who were worried. One of them was Bill Clinton, because he is a political mastermind. He knows a campaign in trouble when he sees one. But most people thought, you know, it's Donald Trump's going to go down. Donald Trump thought Donald Trump was going to go down. So what is the psychosis here? The Richard Nixon, Hillary Clinton psychosis, which people have already, they've already been comparing those two since she burst on the scene in 1991. What about people who seem like they have all the cards drives them to become this paranoid and weird? Like, why even bother to do this is my question.
Yeah, Rob, this is a hard question. This is something prosecutors can't figure out, right? This is going to be probably some psychiatric report on one of Hillary Clinton's servers, which means it's probably in the hands of China and Russia right now. Who knows? But this is part of it. This, you know, it was going to be a close election. Hillary tried, just like President Nixon tried, every dirty trick in the book. The sad thing about the Durham report is how far this dirty trick went.
Yeah.
And right. Durham's report is telling us, in a way, it's the answer that you're looking for. I think, Rob, is the answer is not going to come from throwing people in jail. It's going to come from Congress, right, mm-hmm. radically restructuring the FBI and the Justice Department and making a difference in the 2024 elections. Aren't you struck by how all the people who are in the Obama administration are now, you know, back for a rerun with the Biden administration, how a lot of these names that you see in the Durham report were part of the, you know, 51 intelligence officials who, you know, said the Hunter Biden laptop don't look here. Right. There's still a chance to hold them accountable, Rob, but you have to do it through elections and politics. You know, Durham basically said, you can't, the Justice Department can't fix this problem for you. If you got these people at the top of their parties who are, you know, running these crazy campaigns, doing these terrible things, and then have lots of willing underlings, we can't solve that problem by throwing them all in jail.
John, I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know whether you're going to answer it, though, because I am told by our producer that we had to swear that you could leave.
He can't leave.
Something like 3 minutes. Apparently, you have to get to the McDonald's before they stop serving breakfast.
Oh, you have just invited a blizzard of photos from me to you to show proof. That's right where I'm going. That's right where I'm going.
I'm going to ask two questions really fast, and then you do as much as you have time to do with them. Question number one, when you were at the Department of Justice, during the administration of George W. Bush, if you had been told that a couple of decades later this would happen, you would have said, oh, sure, there's corruption around here. Or you would have said, impossible, not in the FBI, not at DOJ. That's question one. Question two, Vivek Ramaswamy, who's running for president, has said, okay, that's it. J. Edgar Hoover, we know what the nonsense J. Edgar Hoover got up to because your former judge, Larry Silberman, was responsible for reading through the Hoover correspondence. And he said it was the worst job he ever had.
Can I say something about that, Peter? Yeah. I used to beg him, nag him every time I talked to him to reveal something, the secrets. To something about what was it. Just one little thing. He never would tell me. He would curse at me a lot. That would usually string some curses. So whenever he was giving me a hard time about something that I didn't want to tell him, I would always say to him, can you tell me something from the Hoover files? And they would, John, you blah, blah, blah. You know, I can't tell you anything about that. So usually that's how I would win arguments with him.
All right. J. Edgar Hoover was corrupt. Yeah. Mark Felt, yeah. Deep Throat, we now know, was a self-serving FBI bureaucrat who brought down Richard Nixon. And now we have this James Comey, whose self-regard is breathtaking and who was engaged in corrupt activity up to his nostrils. Vivek Ramaswamy says, that's it. Shut this thing down. End the FBI and let's come up with a new domestic intelligence and law enforcement bureau from scratch. And John Yoo says yes or no. Those are two questions. I will now fall silent. Yeah, yeah.
I don't think defund the police is a winning message for Republicans. So I don't think that's a good idea. But I take your point.
FBI? All right.
No, back when I was in 01 and 02, I helped draft the Patriot Act. I lobbied on Congress for it. Not lobbied is the wrong word, but I worked with Congress to get it passed. And I never thought this would happen. I thought the lessons from Watergate were well learned and hardwired into the Justice Department and the FBI, not to use these awesome powers for anything but terrorism and counter-espionage. So it seems to me the answer, Peter's tricking me because he knows I'm an optimist, and so I don't think this is the end of the world. I don't think we should get rid of the FBI. I actually think the problem might be that the FBI is too big and has too many responsibilities. And I think counterintuitively, the thing to do is to have the FBI focus only on terrorism and espionage and stop trying to do bank robberies, kidnappings. Let the other federal agencies be in charge of money laundering and be in charge of securities fraud and just have the FBI focus really purely on the external threat and not try to patrol around the United States and trying to catch people, trying to catch politicians for the dirty business that is politics. And the last point is, this is what the British do. I know you and Rob love the monarchy and want to imitate everything in Great Britain for reasons I don't know. I know you guys were working to watch, you woke up
I'm
before
sitting
I
on to an watch the coronation. Yes.
But I think in this case, the British are right. In Great Britain, they separate this function out. So there's like MI5, MI6, from the movies, but they actually separate it so the FBI would actually be two separate bodies. Because when you mix fighting terrorists and fighting spies and you mix it with policing domestically, bad things result. This is now the second time we've had to go through this because of this problem. I think that's the permanent long-term solution.
How likely do you think that's going to happen?
Well, we had a chance to do it after the 9/11 attacks.
Right.
If the Republicans were to win the Senate and the presidency, I could see that happening again. I think people are really should be upset about this. This is a very serious threat to Democratic government if you have an unelected law enforcement bureaucracy that's interfering in elections.
I guess my fear is that we end up solving that problem the way we solved the intelligence problem by creating another umbrella intelligence agency and then a national security apparatus that is tens of thousands of people working all day. I mean, all we did was put another layer on top.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, has not been a happy tale. And so what I'm arguing is decentralizing, actually splitting agencies up into smaller pieces and making them compete and fight with each other for resources and an effort to do a better job. I think centralization has actually been has not had a good track record with our government. And this, I think this is another example, the Stern report.
John?
Speechless. You guys are speechless now. Well, I'm going to get myself now a double.
If you have more time,
double egg McMuffin with sausage, and I'm going to.
I've got it. I have one more question. Do you have 90 seconds more?
Now I got to run. But this is Rob says leave them wanting more. Right?
Yeah,
got to leave the stage while they want one more joke
before they start tossing tomatoes.
Right.
Right.
See you guys.
John, thanks for joining us. We'll see you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye bye.
He knows so much, doesn't he? He's such a smart guy.
He does.
Oh, he's scary smart. He drives me crazy.
So after all this stuff, you're feeling a little ill, you may have to consult a doctor. And if you do, you'll have to consult your health plan. And as you know, health insurance plans can be confusing and expensive. Then when you actually have to use your benefits, there are deductibles, claims, processes, and other red tape to deal with. There is a solution. Crowd Health. Crowd Health puts you back in control of your healthcare and helps you pay for health expenses. We'll talk about this in a minute. I'm on strike as a member of the Writers Guild. I have a very good policy. Writers Guild policy is really, really great, but it is absolutely baffling to use and baffling to understand. And even when the frequently asked questions, I'm not even at that level yet. So I have this great plan and it takes a day and a half to figure it out. But with CrowdHealth, there's a simple, transparent, and affordable solution. As a member of CrowdHealth, you'll get a personal care advocate to help navigate the complexities of health events. Your personal care advocate will even negotiate bills on your behalf. They'll be with you every step of the way and could save you thousands in health bills in the process. You'll get access to a crowd of thousands of other members who are ready to help pay for large health expenses. $40 of your $175 monthly payment helps pay for your care advocate, telemedicine services, discounted prescriptions, and other tools to get you in the best care at an affordable price. The remainder of the monthly payment goes into a Crowd Health account that you own so that you can help others in the crowd pay for their medical expenses as well. You can experience healthcare freedom with Crowd Health. Join crowdhealth.com. That's the URL. Join crowdhealth.com, all one word, and use the code Ricochet at checkout to get your first 3 months for just $99 a month. That's joincrowdhealth.com, all one word, promo code Ricochet. Crowd Health is not health insurance, but it's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply, and we thank Crowd Health for sponsoring the Ricochet podcast. As I mentioned, I'm on strike.
So, Rob, I wanted to make you the guest to talk about that for a minute because we have a lot of listeners who are interested. And, there you are on the front lines of the supply chain to one of the most important commodities, which is our entertainment, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I know this much about, strikes and unions just from history, which is they're usually three-act plays at least, right? This one's going to take a while. And if you involve Hollywood people, it's probably a five-act play. And the sure sign of this to me this week was this hilarious story. I thought it was hilarious in the New York Times called Picket Line and Chill by Gina Sorellis, who is the sex, dating, and relationships columnist for the New York Times.
Sure.
You might think of this as the modern love column meets the Teamsters Union. It's all about how the picket lines are becoming a meetup location and for lonely writers too, who have been, oppressed by COVID or overworked or whatever. And it's controversial. Of course, it's controversial because people say, here's one line from the story. Some strikers also went online to criticize others for expressing interest in dating on the picket line, worried it could overshadow the strike. Apparently, these writers aren't able to multitask. But what's the state of play? What do you make of this crazy scene?
Well, I mean, the the picketing thing is, I mean, eventually there's going to be a picture of me in some embarrassing pose with a sign looking incredibly awkward and embarrassed, because we all have to picket. And yeah. I feel a little bit obligated to picket this time, because I actually, there's about 35 or 40% of everything they're asking for, everything we're asking for, I totally agree with. And about another 30% that I think, oh, well, you know, if you can get it, good. And then there's 30% I think is silly, but you know, you don't get everything, you know? So,
yes.
But like everything else in Hollywood, there's a component, there's a business component to it, which is like, where are you going to pick it? So I'm in New York. So I have a friend who said, like, let's go, only pick at 30 Rock. That's where all the cameras and celebrities are. That's going to be the most fun. Don't go all the way to, Maplewood, New Jersey, where there are a couple sound stages, and pick at that, because can't do that. And you want to pick it, because the problem for the writers is the best time to pick it is early, 5:30, before, you know, in the morning. That's because that's when the Teamsters get to work and they can't cross the picket line. But if there's no picket line, you know, most writers are like, I'll get there around 11:15, you know, with a coffee and a donut. Too late. But in LA especially, it's like, you know, you get to see people you never see, because most writers are never, you know, we don't, you know, hang out. There's no place for us all to hang out. And so a lot of people are there. A lot of people are there with some very important writers, like showrunners and people who do a lot of development. There are younger writers are trying to make friends with the older writers, because, you know, they're not supposed to be working, but that doesn't mean they can't be networking. And then finally there is this kind of like, hey, we're all, you know, like if you're a striking writer and you are kind of flirting with another striking writer, you both know you're not going to go someplace expensive for the date, right? Because you're both claiming to be broke. So you're already kind of in the same boat. And it's the only time you get together. The problem with that article, which I read, was I would never recommend to any screenwriter or probably any professional writer of any kind that they become involved romantically with any other writer or any other screenwriter. It's best to only have one in the family at any given time. Two is dangerous.
Oh, so the real opportunity here is for some cameras to show up and start a reality series of meeting on the picket line.
They already have. Yeah. I mean, the problem with it, the problem in general is that everything is, the business has changed so radically, like everything else, but, and that there's a whole basket of things that you can ask for that address the changes in the business and how it will be going forward. But there's also a whole basket of things that you're asking for that, even if you got everything you wanted, are still not going to solve those problems. And that is ultimately what the Writers Guild is facing, which a lot of trade unions have faced in the past 30, 40 years. Like, even if you got everything, the world has changed a lot, and there's no, you'll get everything you want on your list, but you're not going to get what you really need, which is a time machine. I think a lot of these demands come under that heading.
AI, what's it going to do to writers?
I would be embarrassed as a writer to say they're going to try to replace me with a robot. Like, really, yes. You're that bad?
But they will, won't they? Some executive someplace is already saying, we don't need these guys. The computers can do this.
Here, I think if you're writing daytime drama, right, where you're just generating material every day, and it's a lot of material, and a lot of it is just people announcing things, right, then maybe you could get a little help from AI. I don't know how. I don't think AI has written a joke yet. Maybe, look, AI may be able to write a joke, and if so, hey, you know, more power to it.
But AI could already handle certain scenes in Days of Our Lives.
Yeah, probably, or at least get you to the outline phase that you need. I mean, here's how I really think of it. These are just tools, right? And if you're not good, the tool is going to kill you. And if you're good, the tool will make you better. And if you're really good, the tool will give you superpowers. That's kind of how what I think about it. Maybe I'm a Pollyanna optimist, but I genuinely think that. In the right hand, if you have talent already, the tool will only make it better. Robotic surgery in the hands of a bad surgeon is not great. Robotic surgery in the hands of a brilliant surgeon is going to be life-saving.
Okay.
Did I silence you?
No, no, no. I'm just. You implicitly compared yourself to a brilliant surgeon, I think. And
no, I just think that the tool can make people. I mean, I don't think I'll ever have to worry about it because I think it's going to happen well into my retirement age, but I would feel I would feel embarrassed to march around demanding that the studios never replace me with a machine. The whole point of what I do is I can't be.
I'm sorry. I have to ask one more because I do find this fascinating. and maybe on one podcast soon, we just make you the guest and we talk about entertainment. So we do know. So computer graphic.
Generated images, I think.
Computer generated images transformed the special effects side of the business and eliminated a lot of jobs. It created some new jobs, but it put into the hands of computer programmers what all people who used to build models, and it transformed that piece of entertainment. We have that question: will AI transform some piece of entertainment? Second question: why shouldn't the writers get everything they want? The big change in Hollywood in the last quarter of a century has been the arrival of more money, lots more money. It's not just the seven major studios anymore. Now it's Netflix and Apple Amazon. And why the heck shouldn't these guys? I mean, the desire, the need for content is bigger than it's ever been. This should be a great time to be a writer. Over to you.
In many ways, it is a great time to be a writer. Writers are making more money and there are more writers employed. There's all sorts of things that are great about being a writer. And the reason why I believe the Writers Guild shouldn't get everything it wants is because some of the things it wants, I think, are bad and will be bad for writers, right? I think, but there's always a balance in Hollywood between talent and luck. And people who are successful think they're successful because they're talented. And people who are not successful think those people are successful because they're lucky. And they're both kind of right. And so what happens in Hollywood is you're kind of sustained by this idea that if I just stay one more year, I'm going to get my big break. Every actor feels that way. Every writer feels that way. Any small little tidbit of success seems to you to point to the totemic of the future of, riches and Oscars and Emmys and everything. And the business kind of works on that because the business kind of works by having this big, big garden where you kind of can live for a while. If you're Quentin Tarantino, you work in a video store for years, all that stuff, right?
Right.
And it kind of keeps you on the hook because what if you do come up with a great idea? We don't want you to come up with a great idea and be living back in Bismarck, South Dakota, right? I mean, not that that's a bad place, of course. We had a great senator from there. But we want you to have that great idea here where I can hear it and put it on TV or put it in the movies.
Oh, a quick idea. Maybe, Peter, we ought to hook up a ChatGPT to some kind of voice box and see if it could produce for us a Ricochet podcast.
Fat, thank you very much. And now somebody turn him off right now.
I didn't mean this one. It could be.
So the question everyone should be focused on this, which is how do you create, right? What is the great secret to the enormous $1 trillion fortunes coming out of Palo Alto, coming out of Silicon Valley? It is not capitalism, really. And it is not the benefits of the people who are risk capitalists and the brilliant, the venture capitalists. It is a nonprofit organizations, Stanford University, Cal, that support, kind of water the garden and create the opportunities, and the federal government creating DARPA and DARPANET, creating the opportunities for great innovation. And that is what this entertainment business should be trying to create. How can we quasi-subsidize a little bit this idea factory that we have? And that, because that's, they don't think that way, they're stepping on their own hose, which I think is a real problem. And that, so whether the writers are correct in everything they want or not, I think it is time for there to be a rethinking of the way show business is conducted. I mean, look, all these guys got big into the streaming business thinking there was the solution without once stopping to think about how this was potentially the dumbest thing they could ever do, which is what they did. And they did so because they were absolutely encouraged to do that by Wall Street, saying, well, what is your streaming plan? Because you look at Netflix, what is your streaming plan? And what they should have said was, let's let Netflix just spend all the money and die. Right. And just see what happens. Right. Netflix is Putin. We're the Ukraine. Let's see how smart they really are. And if they run out of money, which they have. Right. So all sorts of complicated things here. The problem is that it ultimately comes down to some perception of talent and some kind of luck. And you can pick it all day and not get any closer to those two things. So, and in terms of ChatGPT and AI, the people who really should be worried about it are journalists, nonfiction writers. Those are the people who need to be thinking, because those people can be replaced. Most of them can be replaced by an unbiased machine if they ever come up with one.
Right. Mr. Peabody's way back machine. Now what we need is the unbiased machine.
Exactly right. Which we would not need, by the way, if we believed that our journalism was unbiased. Right?
Which, I mean, however,
the journalism created the opportunity. Now, speaking of opportunity, if you've enjoyed this, this comes to you from Ricochet and the Ricochet Network of Podcasts. Please check us out, ricochet.com. We'd love you for to join Ricochet, but even if you just think, I'm never going to join Ricochet, come to the ricochet.com anyway and see all the podcasts that we offer and subscribe. And if you do join, which we hope you do, you'll get to join us at the meetups. The meetups are where members get together. They're fun. And more than that, it's like kind of your duty as a American citizen to meet up with the other like-minded, smart, funny, interesting American citizens. And by the way, if you ever want to make change in this country, you got to meet face-to-face. And this week, we got a bunch of meetup inquiries. Western Chauvinist has inquired about members in the UK. She's going to be around London and Cornwall at the end of the month. So get online. And if you're from the UK or you're around there, you're going to be there, let us know. Let her know. Tory War Writer is back and hoping to meet members in and around Columbus, Ohio in late June. Randy has another meetup set up. He did the New Orleans meetup. It's fantastic. It's another one set up for Winston-Salem mid-July. Matt Balzer is asking for RSVPs for the annual German Fest meetup in Milwaukee. That's the last weekend in July. So we'd love to see you one of these. Join Ricochet. Come. And if you're like, well, I'm not around this summer, well, join Ricochet. Put up a post. How about somewhere closer to you at a time you can make it? Ricochet members will show up. That's what they do. This would be great. I mean, we're sort of run out of time, so I'll just say thanks, guys. Thanks for joining us. Podcast brought to you by Crowd Health. Support them by supporting us, or support them for supporting us. And join Ricochet. Take a minute. If you have a chance to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, your review allows new listeners to discover us. That's how the algorithm works. Helps keep this show and other shows going. Steve, anything you want to say? You sat in. You did a great job.
No, he's done enough damage already.
No, I'm just glad you got to host, so I didn't have to try to do those Schrodinger's cat-like sponsor segues that James does.
Oh man, they're the hardest.
Yes,
I purposely messed them up because I figure it's better for me to do a D-minus version than a B-minus version. You know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Steve, thank you though. You were wonderful until you were suddenly terrible.
Well, that's part of my job, right?
It's true about life. Hey fellas, thanks for being here. See you soon.
Next week. Ricochet. Join the conversation.